tonight. Want to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. I love this program. I love being a part of it, so it's my great privilege to be here. This evening, there is a whole lot going on here at the Modern right now. I think it's a really exciting, kind of busy time, so I urge you to check the website often for the numerous upcoming programs and opportunities that are there. As I've said before, there's nothing sadder than regret that could have been avoided, so you don't want any of that. For example, we have really interesting lectures and presentations in store for the remaining of the remaining Tuesday evenings, with no less than the renowned artist Liam Gillick here to present his work next week. And this coming Sunday, we continue our artist-led tours through Andy Warhol the last decade with art and language artist, writer, and scholar Michael Corus. Tonight, of course, is exactly what I'm talking about. Filmmaker John Smith is here from London to present a selection of short films and to talk about the ideas that have shaped his art for the past 3-plus decades. And as announced, I want to remind everybody that tonight's presentation will run until approximately 8:30 so that we have time for all of that. John is an extraordinary filmmaker with an ordinary name, as illuminated in a wonderful catalog essay for the monograph John Smith, Film and Video Works, 1972 to 2002, by the artist Cornelia Parker. And I can't resist reading this, so please bear with me. Parker writes, John Smith has a sister named Janet. I first met him in Northcote Pub in Leytonstone in 1984. Even before I moved to Leytonstone, I had heard of the legendary John Smith, cult filmmaker, and I was intrigued by the ordinariness of his name. I suspected it was a pseudonym, but if not, hadn't he tempted to change it to something more exotic or strange? Later on, meeting him and seeing his films with their ironic embracing of the ultra-mundane, I realized that the name was a perfect fit, a ready-made. Parker being represented, of course, in this museum's collection by the beautiful Warshak Endless Column, which is currently up on the first floor, and I think all of you are familiar with. She did, in fact, with her husband, the artist Jeff McMillan, introduce me to John Smith and his work a few years back. I am indebted to both of them for this introduction, and I've been waiting for an opportunity to bring John here for Tuesday evenings. Such an opportunity presented itself this fall when I learned that John would be in an exhibition, a solo exhibition at Solidius, a popular artist-directed space and experimental venue in San Antonio this coming weekend. The show, which is titled I Am Lying, I Promise, is an ongoing screening of John's films that begins with an opening this Friday night. And I think it's a great excuse for a road trip, so if you make it, I will see you there. John's conceptually rigorous films, with their incorporation of humor and masterful manipulation of the everyday, have been given retrospective screenings across the globe, including New York, Tokyo, Vienna, and Oberhausen, and have been included in exhibitions such as Live in Your Head at Whitechapel Gallery in London in 2000 and Shoot, 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 which premiered at the Tate Modern in 2002. Most recently, John's work was chosen for the Berlin Biennial this coming summer, and a retrospective is currently in the works for the Royal College of Art, where John studied in the 1970s. I could go on, but I think the point has been made that we are most fortunate to have John Smith here with us tonight, so please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Hello, and thank you for coming out on such a cold night. It's actually colder here than in London, which is a bit of a surprise to me. But anyway, maybe even if I come back, I'll come back a bit later in the year next time. But but anyway, it's great to be here anyway. And I'm going to mainly show you some films tonight, because hopefully the films are a lot more interesting than me. So, but I will talk in between some of them. But I'm going to start off by showing three quite old short films. And and then I'll talk a little bit after that, and then we'll show one more, and I'll talk a bit more, and then we'll show another one. And hopefully, if there's some time at the end, if people have got any questions or comments about everything, anything, that would be great for me, and I hope it would be all right for you as well. But we'll see how the time goes, because I'm sort of anxious to show as much as I can, really, because if you're not familiar with my work, it's sort of there's quite a range of it over a long period of time. And one of the problems of being making film and video work, of course, is it's durational. So I'm only going to show you a tiny amount of what I've done. So I've just sort of put together a sort of a bit of a cocktail of really quite different things. So I'm going to start off with three short films. The first film is made in 1986, and it's called Om. The second film is the oldest film I'm going to show, and I still show this film a lot for reasons I'll talk about a bit later. And that's called The Girl Chewing Gum, and that was made in 1976, actually when I was still a student, but I'm very attached to this film, and I think it forms quite a good introduction to my work, so I'm going to show that as well. And then after that, there's a one-minute film, which was made in 1992, called Gargantuan. And the only bit of prior information I'd like you to have about any of these films is that the third film, if you haven't forgotten about what I'm saying by the time we get there, is it's kind of important to know that it's exactly 1 minute long. And it was actually commissioned by the Arts Council and BBC Television in England in 92. They commissioned a number of artists to make one-minute films, which were kind of interventions within an arts magazine program. So that was the original context for this film. So the brief was, make a one-minute film. And as I hope you'll see from this film, this is very much about 1 minute. Anyway, so we'll just show those three films back-to-back. So that's about 17 minutes or so. And then I'll talk a little bit about what you've seen and what you're about to see after that.
Om. Tiddly-pum. Thank you.
Every 12 hours. Now, two pigeons fly across, and everything comes up again until the girl chewing gum walks across from the left. Okay, now, the man, the woman and the boy, the man with the bag of chips, car roof, the whole car, the old man, the car and the boy, the motorcyclist and the lorry. Now, when the woman at the window looks in this direction, I want everything to move a bit further away. Right, let's have the man in the white boiler suit coming in from the right. Stop at the lamppost and fold your arms. Now, look around you. Walk back to the left again, and look left and right as you cross the road. Now, I want the man reading Exchange and Mart to come in from the right. Now a man comes by and bites his nails. Two pigeons fly past from right to left. Two boys run past from left to right. The woman at the window looks this way and then goes on talking. In a second, I want four boys to come from the left, and I want one of them to look this way and flap his arms up and down. I'd like the boys to remain in more or less the same position, while everything else moves to the left and goes away a bit at the same time. Lift up your arm. Now bring it down. Now I want the man with the turban and briefcase to come in from the right. And now the band marks University of London, Senate House, London WC1. In the cinema queue, I want to see a boy and his mother. The boy will be about 8 years old and his mother about 32. They'll both have collar-length hair, his dark and hers fair. She will be wearing a suede egg coat with a white imitation fur collar. They'll be talking to each other and looking around them. Now, I want the man coming in from the left in the grey pink cap to put on his glasses. The boy will look at his watch and yawn, then look at it again and say something to his mother about the time. Children eating chips, the French woman, the window cleaner in his van, the greengrocer, the pigeon, the red jaguar, the taxi, the man, the van, the negro with the briefcase and the newspaper, the woman firmly gripping the hands of her two young sons. They stop. And now they cross the road. The man in the grey pink cap takes off his glasses again and puts them in his breast pocket. The man with the walking stick is going home. The dentist continues on his way to the bank, and the two naughty boys appear from behind Steels, the plate glass manufacturers, and cautiously cross the road. Steels is situated in an area with a high immigrant population, predominantly West Indians and Greeks. Outside the building, above its main doors, is a board advertising vacancies at the firm. Until recently, I thought the jobs were advertised on the board in two languages, English and Greek. However, a few weeks ago, I studied the board carefully and realised that I had been wrong. Each vacancy has its own slat in the board, and the words, glass cutters, bevelers, bench fitters, etc., are cut out of these slats, which are made of perspex. When a vacancy no longer exists, the slat advertising it, which has a central pivot at each end, is swiveled around. The words that I believed to be Greek were in fact upside down, back to front English. Steels also has another interesting feature. Along each wall of the building, there are 8 large doors that are kept wide open throughout the year. I'm shouting into a microphone on the edge of a field near Lechmore Heath, about 15 miles from the building you're looking at. I'm surrounded by electricity pylons and trees. The sky is beginning to cloud over. In the distance, I can see a middle-aged man in a brown duffel coat. He's got a dog with him, which looks like a Labrador, and I think he's got a helicopter in his pocket. In a tree about 20 yards away, I can see a large blackbird with a wingspan of about 9 feet. This young man has just robbed the local post office and is attempting to appear inconspicuous. He is trying to remain calm, but his hand is sweating as he grips the butt of the revolver in his raincoat pocket even harder. He's wondering whether the woman at the window would recognize him if she saw him again. The burglar alarm is still ringing.
Gargantuan amphibian, enormous amphibian, huge amphibian, big amphibian, strapping amphibian, ample amphibian, medium amphibian, average amphibian, regular amphibian, typical amphibian, oh, little amphibian, modest amphibian, scanty amphibian, petite amphibian, tiny amphibian, diminutive amphibian, weeny amphibian, minuscule amphibian, minute. I love minutes.
So you do call them newts here, yeah? Okay, good. I knew you had Newt Gingrich, but I didn't know whether you called the animal a newt here. I hope from those first three films that it's sort of fairly clear that one of the things I'm really interested in is ambiguity and how things can mean very different things depending on the context that they're presented in. And so that's something that I sort of explore in different ways through working with film and more recently video in a number of different ways. Film, of course, is a fantastic medium for exploring ambiguity because we can very easily change contexts of images and of sounds through what we put them against. So we can put images and sounds against each other to determine how we read them. I guess the kind of most straightforward example of that is the first film, Om, where hopefully every kind of meaning that we experience when we first see the film gets actually turned into something else, both within the image and within the sound. And of course, we can also use editing to affect meaning. You might have noticed that these films have little or no editing. I thought I should show something with some editing, which uses editing to do basically to change meaning, and that will be the next thing that we see. I'll just talk a little bit about what you've seen so far, and I think I'll talk about The Girl Chewing Gum. As I said, that's a very early film, but a film that I still show. And the reason I still show it is really I made some discoveries when I made that film, which really influenced a lot of things that I've done since. So, and I kind of come back to that film a lot. So, so that film was made in 1976. It was made at a time when many artists working with film in Britain and also in the United States were making work which was anti-illusionist in some way, that it was trying to actually, it had the opposite ambition to mainstream cinema. Probably some of you know about structural film, and there was sort of this movement if we want to call it a movement. It wasn't really a movement, but critics invented that. But basically, lots of people were making work which attempted to, in some way or another, draw your attention to the fact that you were watching this physical thing, a film, an object which had been made. And it had the opposite of ambition to mainstream cinema, which kind of wants us to forget that. And if a mainstream film is successful, a lot of people would say it's because we forget that we're watching something which is construction. But this film sets out to draw your attention to the fact that you're watching a construction. But the way in which this film does it is through actually denying the existence of cinema. So hopefully the denial of the fact that there's anything to do with film actually draws your attention to the artifice of what you're looking at. So you probably notice that I don't actually mention anything to do with film in this film. I talk about the world and control the world. So instead of asking the camera to zoom in, which is what happens, I ask the world to move towards me. Instead of asking the camera to pan to the left, I ask the world to move to the right. And there are sort of various different devices in the film, hopefully, to sort of draw your attention to this artifice. Towards the end of the film, there's a point where I refer to a red Jaguar car, which hopefully reminds you of something that you forgot 3 seconds into the film, because of the power of cinema is so great that we forget that we're watching a black and white film. Hopefully that reminds you that, well, that's what you're watching. But anyway, that was the kind of... they were all things that I'd sort of thought about before I made the film. But when I actually sort of put it together, the thing that really surprised me was how powerful the voiceover was and how that operated really in relation to a voiceover in a conventional documentary. So although you've probably seen a lot of things which are quite like this now, the time that I made this film, I hadn't actually seen a film which actually took an image and put an alternative soundtrack to it and told you it was something other than it was. So I was quite surprised at how effective it was. And when I say it was effective, and when I talk about the power of the voiceover, I don't mean to suggest that you're conned into thinking that those things are actually directed, although you might have doubts in places, but if you're interested, nothing is directed. I just filmed what happened on the street for 10 minutes and then added these instructions afterwards. But I think there's a kind of, when I talk about the power, I think there's a sort of wish to believe in what we're looking at. So, and if the film has a kind of resonance, it's because we know we're being lied to, but at the same time, we're kind of going along with those lies. And I guess a good example of that is towards the end of the film, when the voice appears maybe to have at last have come clean about what's going on and says, I'm in a field 15 miles from the building you're looking at, and in the distance I can see a middle-aged man in a brown duffel coat. He's got a dog with him that looks like a Labrador, and I think he's got a helicopter in his pocket. I don't expect many of you kind of immediately dismiss the fact that you can have a helicopter in your pocket. I think, you know, we try and rationalize these things, and I'm sure that some of you in the audience went through this process of helicopter in his pocket. Helicopters are too big to have in your pocket. Maybe it's a toy helicopter, you know. So, you know, similarly, the boy who's just robbed the local post office, if that's kind of funny, it's because you can so easily imagine that he is that person. And, of course, within the context of this film, we know that all of these things are nonsense and you're being manipulated. But I think, you know, on a more serious note, hopefully it draws attention to the power of words to determine images, whether that's a voiceover in a documentary or a newspaper, a caption for a newspaper photograph, etc. So they were the sort of things that I was sort of exploring there. And so I went on, you know, since that time I've made quite a number of films which actually explore how one can use the voiceover to determine what you're looking at. A film I'm not going to show tonight, but I'll just say a few words about, is a film called The Black Tower, which is a film I show quite often, but it's 25 minutes long, so I didn't put that into the program tonight. But The Black Tower is a film of a tall building that was near a house that I moved into in East London in the early 1980s. And I could see this building from my bedroom window of my house. It was a strange Victorian water tower. It's a very strange-looking building. And because it was a tall building, I could see it as I traveled around this new location that I've moved to. I could see this tower in lots of different places, and quite often I'd sort of see it at the end of the street and think, that's really strange. I wouldn't have expected it to be there. And I'm sure you've all had that experience of, you know, a landmark building that you sort of sometimes pops up and you think, oh, I don't think it would be in that direction. And with this film, anyway, what I did was I took this, I basically filmed the tower from as many angles as I could see it in different locations, and then wrote a narrative which actually is a kind of sort of pastiche psychodrama, which talks about the tower following somebody around. So through the use of the voiceover, I kind of suggest that the tower, which is just the same building being photographed from different angles, is actually in different places. So, you know, maybe I'd frame it from between two blocks of flats and say it was there, but then I'd frame it so that all you could see were a couple of trees in front of it. So then the character in the film goes to the countryside and then the tower appears. So that's the sort of thing that I manipulated in that film anyway. Not quite sure why I'm talking about a film that I'm not showing, but it relates to what I've just been talking about. But coming back to The Girl Chewing Gum, another thing which I found, which I think was very important to me, was that when I made that film, I sort of realized that I could take, that one can take the most ordinary image and kind of turn it into something else and hopefully make it, if you like the film, hopefully make it extraordinary. So almost all of the work I've made really over the last 30 years uses very, very ordinary circumstances, but through the way in which it's filmed or through the way in which it's put together, hopefully it turns it into something quite different, and always something which refers to, reminds you that you're looking at something which is a construction. So that's sort of origins of like in my formative years kind of being exposed to structural filmmaking is kind of still very kind of strong for me, that I, whenever I make a piece of work, I always want you to be reminded at some way in the film that you're looking at something which is constructed, that it's images and sounds put together. Okay, I'll just give you a little introduction to the second film. There's quite a few connections between the film, between The Girl Chewing Gum and the next film you're going to see, although this film was shot in 2001 and finished in 2003. I quite often take a long time over making films. I quite often gather material and sort of look at it for a long time, or very often I might shoot some material, start editing it, shoot a bit more later. But the film you're about to see is all shot within a period of a week, but it took a long time to sort of think about how it was going to go together and get got assembled. And this film is shot in Vienna, in Austria. And what happened, the origin of the film was that I went to, I was showing my work in Vienna over 3 evenings. So I was invited to go to Vienna, and I was staying in a hotel in Vienna, and I had a pretty bad cold, and all I had to do in the evenings was show the film. So I spent a lot of time in my hotel room, and I got very interested in the view from the hotel room window. I was in a sort of fourth-story hotel room, looking down on a street that had trams that we don't have in London, so that was quite an exotic thing for me. And I was also initially kind of really interested in the road markings on the streets and the tram lines looking down through the overhead cables and the street markings for pedestrian crossings and all these sorts of things. But I also got really interested in Viennese traffic regulations, because I was looking at a point where two roads came together. And it felt a bit like, it kind of relates to Girl Chewing Gum, really, so I'm trying to control the world. But it felt a bit like, you know, I was God up on a cloud looking down at the world, and I could see things that people in the world couldn't actually see. And I could see two roads coming together, and there were traffic signals telling people to stop and go and traffic to stop and go. But what I couldn't work out was that the traffic signals were telling pedestrians to cross the street, and what I could see was that there were lorries coming around the corner, and I thought, this is a bit dangerous. I couldn't quite work out why it was, but I sat there watching it for a while, and fortunately nobody got run over, but it was sort of strange. I couldn't really quite work out what the rules were. And it was a very busy street corner, and one of the reasons that it was really busy was that there was a sandwich shop with a tram stop outside it. So a lot of people would be going into the sandwich shop, picking up a sandwich, coming out, waiting for a tram, eating their sandwich. And so it was a lot of people watching to do, which is always quite nice when you're in a privileged position looking down on people who can't see you. And so I got interested in this view. But coming back to the kind of traffic situation, one of the things about the sandwich shop was that it, above one of the windows of the shop, it had a sign which had the German words for sausage and cheese, Wurst and Käse. And I read this as worst case. And so I thought, I'm going to construct a kind of worst case scenario, bearing in mind my worries about the safety of the people down in the street. And what happened was I went away, and then 2 years later I came back, and I think the people who ran the hotel thought I was a bit strange. I phoned them and said, I've got to stay in the same room. And I didn't know where it was, but they finally found this room. So I came back 2 years later, stayed in this room, and I spent a week in this room with a camera at the window. Actually a 35mm still camera, just taking normal still photographs. And over the course of the week, with a friend of mine that came with me to help, because I was slightly worried about people thinking I was this funny voyeur, and I thought I need somebody with me. And he's a cameraman too, so we sort of shared the work. But over the course of a week, I ended up taking about 4,000 still photographs of what was going on down in the street. And later on, took them back and assembled them to create a worst-case scenario. So what you're going to see is a film completely made from still photographs. The camera had a motor drive, so it could actually take up to, I think, how many? I think 5 pictures per second. So there are a few places in the film where you will see it approaches looking like cinema, but most of the images are very simply cut or dissolved between 2 similar pictures. But that's not really interesting to explain that. I think I'll just show you the film. So this is this film's a bit longer. It's 18 minutes, and be patient with it. It's sort of to do with waiting. So it's very kind of, the early part of the film is very, very slow, and it's very deliberately very slow. So I hope you can adjust to the pace of it, and I hope you like it. And after that, there's one more film that I'll talk about before we show it.
Bye.
So that was quite an interesting film to shoot, because I had no idea, of course, what was going to happen over the course of a week. And so I sort of found myself sort of, as time went on, sort of the different sort of themes started to emerge. So once I'd had taken a few photographs of, some dogs, for example, I knew that I was then sort of looking for collecting images of dogs, people's opening and closing car doors. I thought, okay, that's another thing that could get, that could happen. And also the thing that the kind of, I mean, it's not a very dramatic event. Hopefully in the film it's sort of quite dramatic. The thing that excited me most was when at the end of the day, completely out of the blue, they washed the floors of the bakery and all this water came flowing out through the doors. So it's a, so I kind of, I was sort of thinking kind of quite Freudian by that time, when they're being in the city of Freud's birth, of course, as well. And so I was sort of making all these kind of cod Freudian connections, which hopefully are pretty, well, they're pretty obvious, I think, between eating and sex, and but also with the kind of idea of cleansing, I suppose. And so I was sort of playing around with these things on sort of quite a sort of jokey way, in a way. But well, one of the things that was most interesting for me, really, is the idea of, I mean, I don't know how clear it is from the film, but there's not a great deal of anything kind of sort of special effects-y going on in that film. I'm not putting people in places where they weren't. When people pop up and disappear, I've just photographed, I've had the camera on a tripod and I've photographed the place when they weren't there and when they were there. So very often after I've taken a photograph of somebody, after they leave the place, I take another photograph. So what is going on in the film is basically I'm bringing together different times in the same place. So I was interested in that thing, that experience we've all had of, you know, sort of, oh, if I'd got on that plane, that was the one that crashed, or, you know, if I'd got... So those sorts of things. I don't know whether it was because I was telling Terry earlier that last time I was in the United States, I had the misfortune of being here in 2001 on September the 11th, and I sort of flew out of New York to Chicago on September the 10th. I think that was sort of... I'm not going to go into any details of that, but actually having those sort of... that sense of kind of, oh, that could have been me, is sort of something I'm trying to explore in the film. I knew that I wanted to have a sort of collision of two vehicles, and what was quite nice for me was that when I actually came to look through all of these hundreds and hundreds of images... there were only two images that I had where a tram and a car, actually, one had been in this place and the other one had been in this place, so I could make them touch. So both of those vehicles had actually been in that place on that crossing. And I had no choice. There were no other two images where two vehicles touched, and that they were either space between them or they would overlap. So I quite like that kind of fortuitous... having an image which is dictated by events. So it's but that's kind of a bit of background information. May not be all that interesting to you, I don't know. It was very interesting to me at the time. Anyway, so that's another transformation of something quite an ordinary situation. How are we doing for time? Does anyone know what the time is? Okay, great. All right, so that works out about right then. So there's one more piece that I'm going to show, and this is again is to do with actually staying somewhere and seeing something. I don't usually usually most of my work comes out of a kind of accident, really, in a way that I'm sort of I happen to be. In a particular location, and I see something and want to make a film about it. So what you're going to see in this last film is that, again, it's to do with revisiting a place where I kind of noticed something and had an idea. I went to Cyprus in 2007, And I was staying in Nicosia. For those of you who don't know, since the Turkish invasion in 1974, Cyprus has been divided into two halves. So you've got the south of Cyprus is the Greek side, and the north of Cyprus is the Turkish side. And the border actually runs through the middle of the capital city. So there's actually a kind of no man's land that runs right through the center of the old city of Nicosia. So it's an extraordinary place, because the kind of city is turned inside out, because the center is the margin of the city. Although it's the most beautiful architectural part of the city, it's where all the kind of peripheral kind of industries, you know, sheet metal workshops and things like that, are actually right in the middle of the city. And if you go out in the other directions, that's where the centers of commerce are and things. But anyway, I was staying in this apartment, and it had this view over the whole of the city. So I was in the south, in the Greek side of Nicosia, in the south, looking across the border to the mountains in the north. And I was in a very, again, in a high apartment building. I don't know why these things happened to me, but I was. And it had this fantastic view. And this film is just all shot from this one camera position. But I don't think I need to tell you any more about it. It's the first public screening of this film. I haven't actually shown it before, so I hope it's all right. I hope you don't hate it. I haven't quite got the grading right yet. It's a little bit dark, but you'll get the idea anyway. So it's 8 minutes long, and it's called Flag Mountain. And that's the last piece, and I hope some of you might have some questions afterwards. I don't have anything else to say. So not without prompting, I mean. So hope you like the film. very much. Yeah, it was rather extraordinary experience to sort of, because I didn't really see this flag on the mountainside until night, and when the sun went down, these lights came on the mountainside. So it was kind of quite shocking, really, this kind of extreme nationalistic gesture. Not least because, of course, when you have a civil war in a country, when a country becomes divided, people become refugees from one side to the other. So a lot of people living in the south of Nicosia are looking at where their homes were, where that flag is on the mountainside. There were probably Greek Cypriot farms on that side of the mountain. But I had a very ambivalent attitude to it, because I also thought it was really beautiful, and I just kind of really thought it was just a wonderful kind of spectacle. And on one level, I kind of, it would be a long conversation to talk about, but I had very, very mixed feelings about it. And I kind of, on one level, there was something quite attractive about this very straightforward gesture of nationalism when we live in a world where there's a lot of nationalism which is very discreet and covered up. So at least you know exactly where you stand with a symbol like that. Yeah. There's not really much ambiguity. Anyway, did anybody have any questions about anything? Or
I wanted to know, with the worst case scenario, all of the sound, was it cutting room sound, all of it?
As much of it as I could was recorded on location, but I might as well say none of it was, because I did actually record other things later, so I didn't have, you know, the sounds of car doors banging, and my recordings of dog barking weren't good enough, you know. So, but the you know, the tram sound and the atmosphere sound in the street is all taken from Vienna, yeah. But it's a kind of, but it's all very constructed, of course. It's all a complete collage of sound. So
I thought it was actually like your process of putting it together, but that wasn't the sound at all.
Oh, sorry, no, it wasn't. It was I did play it a little bit loud, actually, because in fact those sounds are supposed to be kind of quite low key, and they're just sounds of like a chair creaking and the sound of lighting a cigarette and sounds of writing. And but what I was trying to do was basically the ideas behind that had to do with like creating another space. So I wanted to really through sound create the sense of another space, of an interior space, and I guess at the end is explained when we see the camera up at the window. But I wanted to sort of heighten this. There's a kind of uncomfortableness about it, because it is kind of, you know, it's very voyeuristic. Of course, I've got a very long telephoto lens looking down on the street, and a lot of those people don't notice because I'm high up. So it's like I am spying on people. There's no doubt about that. And so I wanted to sort of make that very kind of, you know, to actually really acknowledge that and make that sort of something that was a strong part of the film. But it's sort of to do with different levels of looking, the film, really, because I don't know how clear it is, but all the colour shots are shots which are kind of meant to represent the points of view of people at street level. So they're all the colour shots, the few colour shots that are in the film, with the traffic lights and the cakes in the shop window, they're taken at street level from that kind of perspective, and of course looking up at the window. So I wanted to create this sort of this sense of looking, people on street level looking, and also somebody in another space looking. And I've edited the film to sort of suggest that people are looking at each other, yeah, and again, it was sort of, I think it was interesting because I shot it early 2001 and I started editing it later that year, early into 2002. And back to 9/11 again, actually. After September the 11th, there was, certainly in Britain, there was a lot of suspicion of people from other cultures. And so I've actually sort of, in this film, kind of, it's probably very, how much that comes across, I don't know, but I've sort of actually sort of tried to make, have the sense of people actually looking at each other and kind of wondering, you know, kind of, is that person, you know, sort of a problem for me, or, I don't know, it's a sort of minor thing, but it came up quite a lot in my mind when I was actually doing the edit. It's because of that terrible, you know, there was sort of, a lot of stuff in the press and stuff, which I don't want to go into about. the suspicion of basically the kind of way which immigrants became suspicious, you know. So,
but you were the person that was out of place in that situation.
I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just intended to raise those sorts of things anyway. Originally, it was going to have a much stronger kind of Freudian element to it, so you may wonder why the shot of the Freud Museum is at the beginning. But when I first went there, I having sort of decided that I want to make this film called Worst Case Scenario, I went to the Freud Museum, and anybody who's been to the Freud Museum will know that one of the first things you see when you go into the Freud Museum is a glass case containing Freud's monogrammed suitcases. Because Freud, fled Vienna from the Nazis and went to England, and the Freud Museum is his house. What was his house? And the few kind of artifacts of Freud's life that are left in the Freud Museum are now kind of fetishized. And one of the things that is still there are a lot of suitcases that he never took with him. So I found it quite interesting having this kind of pun about worst case scenario in my head, going to the museum and seeing these suitcases, and then I started to think of like Freud's case histories, and so I actually spent a lot of time getting permission to photograph Freud's suitcases, and I actually animated these monogrammed suitcases so they opened, and originally that was going to punctuate this film, but when I actually came to edit, I thought it's just too much to have this extra ingredient, so it ended up on the cutting room floor anyway. But I quite liked having this, just having the shot of the Freud Museum at the beginning, just to kind of set a kind of tone, I hope, if people remember it. I don't know.
It's a expectation.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did it rain at any time during the shooting of that horse case?
Did it rain
during that week of the
show? Oh, right, yeah. No, it didn't, but that's an interesting point, actually, because it's one of the reasons that the film is in black and white, is that the light changed a lot. And so very often you might have a sunny day or a very dull day or something in between. And I shot everything originally in colour. And when I came to look at the material, I realised that I had to turn it all into black and white in order to make the shots cut against each other. Because if you've got a colour shot on a sunny day, putting it against the shot on a dull day, they won't match. It's very clear that they're taken at different times. Whereas with black and white image, you can just increase the contrast or reduce the contrast and actually get images shot in very different lighting conditions to work together.
I thought that the idea of people scurrying in and out of the rain would be a...
Yeah, no, that would have been great, actually. Yeah. Yeah, it would be nice to have some things with umbrellas. So, like the slight movement of an umbrella would be really good. In fact, with this film, actually, the bits that I like most, having made it, are the very subtle movements where you're kind of not sure whether you're looking at movement or not. For me, it's kind of more interesting than the kind of more dramatic bits. But So some of the
you mentioned that you wanted to remind people that the film is a construction. Was that part of the purpose of the interior space?
Why are you asking why I want people to know that the film's construction?
You mentioned that you wanted people to be reminded that they were actually watching a construction.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if the interior space, if that was a way to remind people that they were watching a construction.
Yeah. I mean, this film, in a way, I mean, because it's all made of still photographs anyway, it's kind of very artificial. Mm-hmm. I think you're reminded of that all the time. it's a lot to do with like getting a sense of distance. You know, when you hear this very close up interior sound, if you're less involved, you are actually looking from a distance more. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it is making you more aware of the construction. Yeah. Yeah. It makes you very aware that you're not hearing the sound of the street.
I thought that the person making the squeaking noise in the chair was orchestrating the event.
That's
my feeling.
The film sort of, the kind of silence is very important in that film, actually. I mean, I hope it found the silence loud. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, it's happening within the kind of texture and working with different volume levels and things. Silence can be like a really, really powerful thing, I think. Especially, I was playing the sounds a little bit loud. I don't know if he's got a headache. I'm going a bit deaf, which is why I'm having to come closer to you. Yeah?
My question is about the last video you showed. I just want to ask you, is there anything, has it got anything to do with Northern Ireland? Because you both spoke about...
Northern Ireland,
I'm not asking in Northern Ireland with that. The British Army have this observation for between the north and south.
Yeah.
So they look down the people,
yeah,
smuggling and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to video the Turkish side without doing the other side?
Well, I was thinking of doing the other side, and it's sort of important to me that what I'm concerned about with this new film is that I don't want it to seem as though it's kind of like a critique of specifically of Turkey. Yeah? I very deliberately kind of, the first shot of the film, I don't know if you remember, has Greek flags flying in. So there's nationalism on both sides, you know? And it's not, I didn't want it to sort of seem as though kind of one culture was dominating another. But this piece, actually, I'm also going to be showing it in a gallery exhibition without the titles, as a continuous loop. So it just carries on moving backwards and forwards. And I hope that kind of will actually kind of resolve that issue a little bit, so it doesn't have a conclusion. You know, I very deliberately, you know, when you're looking at a film like this, at the first part of the film, you're hearing the muezzin in the mosque calling people to prayer. Then you're getting the Turkish national anthem, and at the end, you're hearing the church bells from a Christian church. So, I don't like the fact that they're in an order in a way, because I don't want to kind of create any kind of hierarchy there between those things. So, but I think it's been, I've tried it as a loop without the titles, and I actually really like how it works in that way. It didn't, it's funny you mentioned Northern Ireland, because accidentally, before I went to Cyprus, immediately before that, I was in Israel and Palestine, and I was rather very horrified by what I saw there, especially with the wall that was being built, Israel separating it from the occupied territories of Palestine. And I was just really, I went on a study tour there, and it was a very heavy week, and it was very, very depressing. And by chance, my wife was teaching a workshop in Cyprus, so we flew straight from Tel Aviv to Cyprus. And I hadn't thought before we got there that I was going to another completely divided place. So it was, I thought, oh no, another divided city. And actually, earlier that year, I had been in Northern Ireland as well. So in 1 year, I could have gone to these three places, all of which have that very physical.
Actually, I made that connection because the British Army have a huge presence in Cyprus.
Yeah, the British do. Yeah.
And so almost all the soldiers that go to Iraq leave from Cyprus.
Yeah.
Northern Ireland, same thing.
Yeah.
And they're always kind of looking from this observation post with huge camera, surveillance photography, and all that.
Yeah, well, the British still actually have, I mean, the British are responsible for a lot of the mess left in the world, and one of them is Cyprus. And a lot of people say that the British, when they were forced out of Cyprus, actually left a situation which was obviously going to cause a conflict between the two communities. Because they operated like they did in many other places, a divide and rule policy in order to keep control. And Britain still actually legally own whole areas of Cyprus, which are their British territory. And in fact, that's where the central listening posts for the all of this kind of scary technology for what's going on in the Middle East is based there. It's incredible. If you drive through, you have miles and miles of these kind of radio masts and things picking up God knows what signals. Yeah.
I'm curious. I noticed several of the people in the film, Worst Case Scenario, noticed you taking photographs of them. And I was just curious as to how many people you didn't show that noticed you and what they
How many did I not show that noticed you?
Right.
Yeah. None. I used every photograph I had of people who noticed it. Obviously, people noticed me, and I didn't manage to photograph them while they were looking at me.
Right.
I used all of the images of people looking.
There
are many. Actually, there's one that I didn't include, which is the hotel manager going. maybe I should. It would have kind of changed the mood a little bit. I still wonder what the hotel manager thought would be. I didn't really explain it to him. He didn't really speak much English. I just said, I want to book into your hotel and take photographs from a window for a week.
I have a two-part question. The first one is, do you enjoy putting the stills together more or the film? And then in your watching people, because we're people watchers too, what is the one thing that has stood out in all your people watching? What has surprised you the most that you've seen that shocked you or surprised you that you were surprised to see or something?
The first part of your question is I enjoy
the still
editing both the still images and the moving images. I come from making, although I work mainly video now, I come from working in films, and movie films are still images now. So I've just changed from this where I've got an indeterminate length image to a piece of film where I have 24 still images per second. So I kind of think in still images anyway. And actually my earliest films were actually animations of still photographs, so I came to filmmaking from photography. Editing is the part of filmmaking that I enjoy the most, actually, because it's not so stressful. You can do it in your own time, and you make discoveries, and it's good. I just really like the fact that things completely come out of the blue. I very rarely script what I'm doing in any kind of conventional way, so I plan things, but I don't. It remains quite organic. I'm not really sure what's going to happen in the material until I get into the cutting room and start working with it. And the second part of your question was actually in this film, in terms of people, what I was amazed by was that the people who did notice me didn't mind that I was filming them.
I think it's pretty different in different places. I don't know what it would be like here, but certainly in London, if I was coming to a window and people saw I was filming them, a lot of people would be very cross. In fact, someone would probably be at the door or banging on the door. whereas it seemed to be, people seemed to be less bothered there. Which in a way is surprising, because in London, we, I don't know if you know, but we have the highest concentration of security cameras in the world. I mean, it's horrific. And now everybody is being watched by cameras all the time. So in Vienna, they don't have that. I don't think they've got many security cameras at all, but people didn't seem to mind the fact that somebody was photographing. I think if I'd been in Eastern Germany, and maybe it would still kind of would be thinking that, you know, the Stasi were back and the spy over there. But it wasn't really that feeling.
You spoke a little bit about your transition from photography to film to video. I was wondering if the way you changed your process has affected your attitude toward the way you structure your films.
Yeah, it has a little bit, actually. Well, certainly this last film, Worst Case Scenario, is not a film that, it's a video. it's not something I would have been able to make on film. Because I do, although you can do, you know, special effects and stuff at laboratories and things, I'm a very kind of hands-on person. I like to do everything myself. I do everything, you know, at home. So I couldn't have done those things of superimposing, dividing the frame and having movement in one half of the frame and nothing happening, staticness in the other half of the frame, without going to a very expensive process of going to laboratories and getting them to do it and not really knowing what it was going to look like until they'd done it. So, but you probably know Apple Final Cut Pro editing program, which is which you could do an amazing amount of stuff on. So I just do everything at home on my computer now. I've still got my big film editing machine sitting there, which I love very much, but it's becoming more and more of an ornament, unfortunately.
In the beginning of your work, I mean, what things in your life helped you realize that you had insights into, you know, into the world and people that you wanted to try and, preserve and picture,
That I had what?
Well, you had insights that you wanted to try and, take pictures of first and then later move into films and stuff.
I can't remember. I went to art school and originally did a design course at art school, although now for many years I've been involved in fine art rather than design, but that's how I started. And I think actually it's kind of accidental how I ended up making films. I actually had a young... there was a tutor teaching film. There's an artist called Guy Sherwin, some of you might know him. He's quite a well-known British artist filmmaker. And Guy was the tutor at the first college I went to. And he was only 3 or 4 years older than me, unlike most of the other tutors, who were much older. And he was just kind of excited about having discovered this new medium to work with. And his kind of excitement was really infectious. I suspect maybe if I had met a really enthusiastic and passionate typographer, maybe that's what I'd be doing. It's interesting, the kind of accidents of how we end up doing things. I mean, I went to art school because it was fashionable. I wasn't really interested in art. That's what people did, you know. I went to art school. I didn't want to get a job. And I thought art school would be fun, and everybody could, you know, we can all go there and smoke marijuana and that's what I did. But then I discovered I really liked art. But that wasn't really the reason I went. Anyone else?
That was
throwing out that.
So good.